In chapter 2, God first appears on the scene. We talked about the fact that in chapter 2, even though God isn't directly mentioned, the author is using what's called the divine passive. And only when you see God in this divine passive do you then begin to make sense of what's happening. And that's how life works. Life works in a way that, you know, that if you don't fill in the gaps with God, life doesn't make sense. So we get into this situation now where we're moving into the action. And the action is centered around Mordecai and this plot that takes place. And last week I said that there's some other things that we find out about Mordecai before that. And so we're going to go backwards a little bit. We're going to use some of what we see here in this plot and with some other things we saw earlier. And we're going to really pay attention to him because this is really the first time that we get a strong sense of what it means or what it looks like to live our faith out in a godless society. Now, again, for those of you who aren't Christians, that might not be a big deal to you. You might go, well, I'm not really here to find out how to live my faith out because I'm just trying to figure out if I have any faith, if it's worth putting my life into this. And this is my encouragement to you today. For a lot of us, we really do need to see what it looks like to live a life of faith in the midst of the society that we live with that's becoming increasingly more secular, increasingly more ungodly. But even if you're not a believer, this hopefully gives you a picture of what true faith is supposed to look like. I think a lot of times what happens is, you know, we look at Christians in society and we see that they're, unfortunately, Christians don't always have a really good look, do we? You know, we see Christians that when disasters happen, they say, see, God is punishing those people. That's not Christianity. We see others who are boastful, who are not very caring, who are hypocritical in the things they say and the things that they do, and that's not true faith. So for those of you who are here who aren't Christians, hopefully this gives you a picture of what true faith looks like, especially, again, in our culture, what it should look like when we express and live out our faith in Jesus Christ. So again, we're going to focus on Mordecai, and actually the way that the author writes it, he's actually, to some degree, he's more important than Esther. That's one of the reasons why he's actually introduced earlier than her. In verse 5, we find out about Mordecai. It says, now there was a Jew in Susa, the citadel, whose name was Mordecai. Then it goes on to introduce him. And the first thing we see right off the bat is that in this description of Mordecai, it's not said from the beginning he was an official working in the palace. First thing we find out is he was a Jew. And not just a Jew, but it goes on. He says there was a Jew in Susa the citadel whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jeer, the son of Shimei, son of Kish, a Benjamite. What the author is telling us right from the very beginning, the way he wants us to frame Mordecai as a person is he wants us to see Mordecai not just as a Jew, but as a true Jew. You know, it shows that he shows his lineage, and what he's doing is he's not just saying this is a Jew who by lineage is a true Jew. He is one who spiritually is one also. I mean, that's his point. That's really what the author's getting at, is he's showing us his Jewish roots to tell us this is a spiritual man. This is a man who takes his faith seriously. And we see that, again, Mordecai is very important. He's the reason why Esther is queen at this point. He's the reason why he's the one who watches over Esther. He's the one that directs her. He's the one that encourages her to do the right thing, to do what God wants her to do. He's, in a lot of ways, he's the reason why the events unfold the way that they do. And in doing so, he helps us see what faithfulness looks like, again, in the midst of a godless society. So we are going to look at Mordecai today. We're going to look at him as an example. And he isn't the only example of faith, but we're going to look at him, and we're going to see three ways in which we, too, can live out our faith. So we're going to see three areas or three ways in which he lives his faith out in this society, and hopefully that'll give us some thoughts on how we can live out our faith in our society. The first way that we see, the first way that Mordecai lives out his faith is he lives it out in his public life, in his secular work. If you go to verses 19 and 21, when we start to read about this plot that's happening, we're told something very specific about Mordecai. It says, verse 19, now when the virgins were gathered together a second time, Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate. Now remember that phrase at the end. He was sitting at the king's gate. Go down to verse 21, and it says that in those days, as Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, Bigthan and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs, regarding the threshold, became angry and sought to lay hands on king Ahasuerus. So if you notice, it's emphasized two times, which means by the author that it's very important. And what it's doing is, this phrase that we're being told, he was sitting at the king's gate, is actually not a description of his physical location. The scholars agree that what is actually being stated is it's telling us that he has an office or he has a position in the palace. You know, we use jargon like that too. For instance, for a judge, we say that a judge sits on the bench, right? He's sitting on the bench. That's the same phrase that's being used here, the same idea, saying that he's sitting in the gate. And it doesn't mean that he has a chair there and there's this gateway and there's these two big doors and he's sitting there and all this stuff that seems to happen by him. It's telling us that he is someone who has a place, a position inside the king's palace. And if you notice, you know, not only does he have this position, but because of this position, he kind of hears these information, these things going around, and he hears about this this plan, this thing that's happening. Now, again, the reason why that's important is because, again, we're told from the very beginning that he is a Jew. He's a Jew that he's not living in Jerusalem. He's not living amongst other Jews. He's living in the capital. He's living among people who are not his people. And he has a job that's not a very typical job. He's not working in the temple. He's not working on his own. He's working for this invading country. He's waiting. He's working in the king's palace. And to some degree, it's challenging to his faith. You know, it's not a job that most Jews would be comfortable with. It's not a job that most Jews would aspire to. And it's a job in which it would be difficult to retain your Jewish identity. For instance, if you worked in the palace, there were certain things that would be difficult, that you'd be fraught with challenges. Matter of fact, historically, if you look at it, not just if you're working in the palace, but in general, if you were a Jew and a country came in and took over, it would be difficult to adhere to your Jewish identity. You know, you have a conquering nation come in, and one of the first things they would want to do is they would want to assimilate different people groups. And if you remember, this is a large kingdom. It covers 127 different provinces, covers many different languages, many different people groups, many different customs, many different spiritualities. And one of the things that they wanted to do early on when they took over an area is they essentially wanted to assimilate people by eradicating the distinct cultures and the spiritual identities of people. You know, because in some ways, you know, if you had a group of people within your midst who were still committed to their culture, their spiritual identity, then if they kept those things, that would eventually become a problem. Now, because of their spiritual identity, because of their cultural heritage, they would feel as if they'd have to break out, and there would be skirmishes and rebellions, and we see that in Jewish history. But for Mordecai, even though it was difficult, we find out that he's found a way to keep his Jewish identity. And again, there's lots of ways in which that could have been eradicated, or that would be challenging. For instance, working at the palace means that he probably couldn't keep a lot of the kosher laws. You know, it means that when meals were brought in and when food was being offered and when he was sitting with the other officials, it means that he couldn't say, excuse me, did a rabbi look over this? Or when the pork was being passed, I can't touch that, I can't eat it, can you please take this for me? I mean, he couldn't do that. In some ways, he had to compromise certain things that he might follow otherwise. He also had to give up certain aspects of specific clean laws and details of what he was supposed to do at certain times of the year, certain ways he was supposed to approach eating and eating with people. But even though he had to compromise in certain areas, what we see is a man who hasn't compromised. You know, one of the things that comes out later in the story that I'll kind of key you in on is Haman shows up in the story, and if you remember, Mordecai refuses to bow to him. You know, he refuses to bend the knee and to show him respect. And on the surface, it looks like this personal thing going on, that there must be some reason why, and that there might have been the sense that Mordecai knew Haman a lot better, and he saw certain things in Haman that were problematic. But what most scholars say is that that was a part of his spiritual identity, that for some reason there was something about Haman, his anti-Semitism, or the fact that he could have been particularly pagan in his dress and in his comport. But most scholars point to the fact that for for Mordecai, you know, when he refuses to bow to Haman, what we're seeing is we're seeing a man who, even though he has to compromise certain elements of his faith, he has not compromised his faith. You know, he is still convicted and he still sees himself and other people see him as a Jew. And again, in this particular culture, that's very, very difficult. He has all these different temptations. He has all these different things happening around him. I mean, think about what's taking place. You know, in chapter 1, we see that there's these lavish parties. There's this debauchery going on. And it's assumed, the way that we're supposed to see Mordecai is that he is a man who wouldn't partake in those things. You know, here's a man that even though he has to compromise things in very particular areas of his life, he has not compromised his faith. And you know, that's a very big challenge for us. You know, it's a big challenge for us. How do we work in our job, how do we work in our secular area in a way in which we don't compromise our faith? You know, ways in which we are not simply letting go of all that, saying, you know, whatever we do, we do. And you know, the modern trap is this, and it's a very dangerous modern trap. The modern trap is what most of us do is we divide life into two spheres. We say that there are things that are sacred and things that are secular. And so in the sacred sphere, that's why I'm religious. That's why I adhere to the things in my religion. That's why I do things that I might not do otherwise. In other areas, these are the secular parts of my life. And in there, my faith is really not supposed to go there. That there, I work as a worker. I do my responsibilities, but my faith really doesn't affect that. That's a very dangerous, dangerous way to live. You know, it's actually a lot more dangerous than you tend to think. This is actually the reason why we have this secular sacred divide is because in a lot of ways that's the way our culture teaches it. And we're told that there are certain things that are in the private sphere, certain things in the public sphere. We see that in politics all the time. You know, if you come into a public debate as a Christian, they would say, don't bring your faith here. We're talking about public policy. That's not the place for your personal religion. Oh, yes, it is. Yes, it is. And the reason why is because what is everyone else doing? They might not believe in God, but they're bringing their personal beliefs into it too, aren't they? I mean, they're bringing their personal beliefs about marriage, about family, about life, about living. They're bringing their personal beliefs about sexuality, about gender, about equality, all these different things. They're bringing personal beliefs into the public sphere. Now, the fact that they might not believe in a God doesn't make them any more sacred. Now, those beliefs are still deeply personal, and they're still deeply religious. They may not be towards God, but it's towards something. And so it's disingenuous in a lot of ways for people to say, hey, you can't bring your religion here. This isn't the right sphere. And you know, what the Bible shows us again and again is there is no distinction. There is no such thing as private and public, sacred, secular. What the Bible shows us again and again is that we have a God who has eradicated all those differences, and there is just one. All there is life. And all of life, all of living is filled with God. There is not a place that he does not influence. There's not a sphere in our life that he is not included in. And to live that way is actually destructive. What it does is it disintegrates you. You know, imagine this, and not that I live this way, not that hopefully any of you live this way, but imagine living your life essentially in two marriages, with two families. And you know, you've probably seen that in the news. You know, I don't know why, it's salesmen, I guess because they travel a lot. But you know, every once in a while you see a story about a guy who has one family over here on the East Coast, he has another family over here, and years down the road, they find out about each other through some happenstance, and you know, this whole big thing happens. Well, what happens in a situation like that? Well, you have a guy here living with two wives, two families, and even if it doesn't do it at the beginning, at the end, it's destructive, right? News gets out. One wife or one family finds out about the other, an explosion. Let me tell you something. Even if news never got out, it's destructive. I mean, here is a man who has two families, two wives, who never really loves either deeply or deeply enough. There's a man who's never fully committed to one or the other. And because of that, he can never truly be a father to either set of kids. He can never truly be a husband to either wife. He can never truly be involved in either family in a deep way. And what that does is, even though he seems to make it work on the outside, no one ever finds out, it's deeply destructive. You know, because we weren't meant to do that. We weren't meant to divide our time. We weren't meant to separate ourselves out. And what happens is, he ends up living simply to hold the lie together. And eventually, as time goes on, he finds himself falling apart because it's so hard to keep the two things separate. It's so hard to make sure that the lies on this side are, sync up with the lies on this side. And you know, it's a difficult way to live. Now, I don't know if you've ever lived like that in terms of small things, but what happens is it begins to tear you apart. You begin to disintegrate under the weight of it. And even if they never find out, it changes you. And it ultimately destroys you. Jesus talks about that too. He says, you cannot serve two masters. What does that mean? Well, it means, in terms of what we're talking about, you can't live in two spheres of life. You can't say in one sphere that I love this and this is what's most important to me, and in another, no, this other thing is what I live for, this other thing is more important to me. Jesus says, you cannot live like that. When you live like that, it will destroy you. And you see, that's what happens to us. When we fall into this modern trap thinking that life is divided into sacred and secular, we end up disintegrating. Intellectually, it doesn't make sense. And practically, it doesn't make sense. Our lives don't come together. And so sometimes we feel like we're living fake lives because nothing is ever integrated. And if you live like that long enough, you will feel torn apart on the inside. It's a terrible way to live. I know some people who say, well, you know, my faith is for my private life, and my public, I don't talk about Jesus at all. How could you not? How could that not tear you up inside? I know for me, there's times where people share things with me at work, and I don't have to say, oh, you need Jesus, but if I don't tell them, if I don't say something that's genuine to me, and I feel like I'm lying, not to them, but to myself. You know, what the Bible tells us again and again is that life isn't two, life is one. All of it is one big piece. And the good news is, because of that, God sees all of it. God cares about all of it, not just the private part of our life. God cares about the other part too. Just to give you a quick thought, quick application. And again, the purpose of today isn't to give you 10 things you can do at your work this coming week to bring God into your life. But at the same time, to some degree, that's one of the things we're seeing here. What are some ways, or what is a way that you can begin to bridge that gap, that you can begin to live your life of faith out in the place that you work? I think one of the best ways that you can do it, and I think this is a very simple way, we've talked about this with evangelism. I think one of the best ways that is genuine to our faith is simply at our workplace. We don't have to go around and give people pamphlets. I kind of hope you haven't done that. You know, that I don't think those evangelism booklets are all that helpful. You know, you go up to someone's desk and you leave a thing that kind of has flames and hellfire on it, and you know, you find a place to talk to them and say, you know, you're going to hell. And you know, that doesn't work too well in terms of conversation starters. I think a really good thing that you can do with your neighbors, your coworkers, or whatever else is you can actually share your faith in very subtle ways. One of the ways that you can start sharing your faith or living your faith out in your workplace is simply praying for people. I know that sounds really unusual, but I think one of the ways that you can do that is not just in your own private life praying for people, but when you find out about things that are going on in their lives, you know, letting them know that you're going to be in prayer for them. And prayer is one of those funny things a lot of people don't have a problem with. You know, if you're at your workplace and someone shares with you, oh yeah, you know, there's so many things happening in my marriage and we're fighting all the time. If you go, you know what? Yeah, you know, I feel bad for you. I'll be in prayer for you. They won't go, what are you talking about? You know, that's terrible. Why would you pray? I'm insulted by that. I am personally, please do not pray for me. Right? No one says that. No one ever says that. They never ask you who you're praying to either. I mean, they just, whatever they believe, they believe. But no one ever says, please don't pray for me. And that's a great way to be able to do something. And little by little, people might not know that you're specifically Christian, but what they know is they begin to see that you care. And you know, that's really one of the most important things for people to begin to see. I know for me, I don't do enough of this, but I do know that, that the place that I work is with, I've worked for about 4 years now with a company that I actually worked with before for about 5 years. And I know that that's something that I did a little bit with my boss, not with everyone, but I shared this months and months ago, but about a year ago, my boss got sick and found out she had a brain tumor. And it was interesting. It was really a blessing to me that you know, one of the first things she did is she came to me and she asked me to pray for her as she was going through it. And it still hasn't gotten all worked out. And I think there's still a lot of concerns from her and her family that this doesn't look like it's going to end well. But it was interesting to me that for someone that I worked with, you know, when things were really difficult, she wanted people to be praying, and she sought that out. Is that one piece going to cause her to become a believer? I hope it does. It might not, but I think it starts to make a difference. And that's a great way to begin to integrate your faith into your work. Again, not that you have to then take lunch breaks and sit next to different people and tell them about Jesus. You know, let me tell you about Jesus. Well, please don't. You know, that's kind of how the conversation typically goes. But what you can begin to do is you can begin to do things in faith. You can begin to exercise your faith in ways that are very genuine, in ways that are very normal, that aren't going to weird people out. And eventually those speak volumes to people. But that's what we see in Mordecai. We see that he's able to work in the public sphere and yet not compromise his faith. He's still able to be distinctively Jewish, distinctly a believer, and to act and function that way. And again, that's a very important thing for us to think about what that looks like. Second thing we see here is we see Mordecai's faith living out in his life through the care of Esther. If you go to verses 5 through 7, we have this description. And again, you know, verse 5, we have this description that that Mordecai is a Jew. He is a true Jew, you know, in the sense that he is a Benjamite. And then if you keep going, in verse 7, it says, he was bringing up Hadassah, that is Esther, the daughter of his uncle, for she had neither father nor mother. The young woman had a beautiful figure and was lovely to look at. And when her father and mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. Now, in verses 5 through 7, the author actually explains the relationship between Mordecai and Esther. And what's funny is I've actually watched the VeggieTales version a bunch of times, and I've done some other stuff for this. I never noticed this. Like, I always thought that Mordecai was her uncle, you know, and that when Esther's parents died, you know, he just kind of stepped in and, you know, took her on. And that's, you know, that's in some ways that's expected. What we actually find out here is that he's not her uncle. If you notice, he's the daughter of his uncle. So actually, the author is very clear to point out that it's a distant relationship. You know, it's a distant, it could be a second, could be, you know, it's, in other words, it's not a direct kind of relationship. He's not, even though she's his niece, it's not necessarily that there's a direct connection. And you guys know how it is with your families. There's parts of your family you know better, parts of, you know, not as well. But the writer is actually making a point. Scholars are pretty consistent on this, and it was very interesting to read this. The point is this, and again, this is something I never would have noticed that the scholars have kind of picked up on, and that they're all pretty much in line with. They say that the reason why that's important is because it's an emphasis here that Mordecai did not take on Esther because he has some spiritual religious responsibility according to the Torah. Now, in the Torah, there's lots of requirements about how some of these relationships work. And essentially what most of the scholars say is he's saying what we're seeing here with Mordecai is we're not seeing a relational thing where because he's a Jew and because she's related to him in a very specific way, he's required to do this. We're not being told that this is his brother's child, and so out of familial relationship or responsibility, he does this. What we're actually being shown is the relationship is distant, and what the scholars say is what we're seeing is we're seeing that Mordecai isn't just a spiritual person. He doesn't just go to temple and follow feasts and festivals. The author is trying to tell us that he's also a compassionate man, that he takes his faith seriously outside of the things that are required. In other words, in the Old Testament, God's people are told again and again to care for the orphan and care for the widow. And here we see a man who takes his faith seriously enough to do that. That here he has this distant relative that he may or may not have known. He's not spiritually responsible for her. He's not spiritually required according to custom to take her on. And what does he do? He adopts her. Even more importantly, he does something else. We're told that he treats her as his own. That doesn't speak to responsibility. That speaks to compassion. Now, the author is trying to show us that Mordecai isn't just a God-fearing Jew, he is a compassionate Jew. He is a man who takes his faith seriously, not just because he goes to temple all the time or he reads the Torah or, those types of things. It tells us that he takes his faith seriously, so much so that it affects his life, that he's willing to take in people that he has no obligation to take in and to love them and to care for them in ways that no one else would. Just the fact that someone adopts someone doesn't mean that they're compassionate. I remember one of my first experiences meeting a family who had adopted, was very good friends of mine when I was in elementary, and this family, Caucasian family, had adopted a Korean girl into the family. They had two sons, and they adopted a girl who was the youngest. And I didn't know the girl as well. I knew the two sons. They were about my age, and we did a lot together. And one of the things that I remember about that family, about their relationships, is I remember seeing these little moments of her with her brothers, her with her parents, where it really wasn't that loving. It really wasn't that affectionate. It really wasn't a lot of times that kind. And over time, I didn't really think about it, in the moment. It's something that I kind of reflected on years and years later. But looking back, here's a girl who was adopted in the family, that she was simply treated as a responsibility. And again, she wasn't seen, it seems like she wasn't really seen on equal par with the sons. And there were times where little things were done that communicated that she was a burden, that she was difficult. And that's not what we see here with Esther. The author tells us very, very simply, very precisely, that he took her as his own daughter. And, all of that is meant to point us to something. It's meant to show us that Mordecai took his faith so seriously that he was willing to do this, even though it wasn't a technical requirement, even though it wasn't something that he had to do. He loved God in such a way, and he took his faith seriously in such a way that he was willing to do this out of love for his Lord. Let me share this, and this might seem like a different path, but I do think that's an important component of what it looks like when you do take your faith seriously. I think when you take your faith seriously, you begin to realize it doesn't just affect your Sunday of whether you come to church or not. It doesn't just affect, whether you read the Bible in the mornings or not. It doesn't just affect whether you join a small group or a community group or growth group or whatever else. I think when you really come to know and love God, it begins to affect all these other areas of your life, all these things that you never thought it would affect. You begin to find yourself doing things that aren't necessarily for you. You find yourself becoming you find yourself doing things out of compassion. You find yourself doing things out of sacrificial love. And you could say, but Pastor Young, there's other people who aren't believers who do those things too. I agree. But I would also say this. I think Christianity gives you even deeper resources to be compassionate and to use your life sacrificially for the help of others. There are lots of people who do charity work, lots of people who have. Matter of fact, I will tell you, there are people who aren't believers who give a lot more money away than any of us would ever dream. There are some people who aren't believers that will use more time, more energy than we would ever have to do things that are a blessing to other people. But sometimes what happens, not all the time, but sometimes what happens is if God isn't a part of that charity work, if God isn't a part of that process by which they are wanting to be compassionate, wanting to be sacrificial, without God, sometimes what that does is it makes people like that ultimately arrogant and proud. And sometimes that happens to us too. But without God, sometimes that makes that even good charitable work begins to corrode your soul. You know, you begin to do all these wonderful things. You begin to work with orphans, widows, with those who are suffering, with those who are sorrowful, with those who are in great difficulty. And sometimes you're really not doing it for them. Sometimes you're really doing it for you. Or sometimes you begin to do it, and instead of compassion, you begin to feel a deep pity. And you begin to look down on them. And you begin to say, boy, you know, you begin to do things acting as if you're a savior. And all of those things, what they do is they don't make you better, they actually make you worse. They make you arrogant, they make you proud. And ultimately, it isn't for other people, it's for yourself. What I will tell you is this. When you put God into the equation, when you know God and you begin to do those things, ultimately, it makes you humble. And the reason why is this. As a Christian, what the gospel tells you is that you too have been adopted, that you were an orphan, that you were far from God, and it was only through the death of the true Son, the only beloved, the one who is God's Son. It's only through his death that you are brought in. And when you serve out of that gospel understanding, it doesn't make you proud. It doesn't make you arrogant. Matter of fact, when you begin to show compassion to someone who is an orphan, someone who's a widow, it actually reminds you of what spiritually you are and you were. And so as you begin to serve them, you don't begin to put on airs. You don't begin to feel like their savior. You don't begin to feel proud. You don't begin to become arrogant about that. When you put it in the lens of the gospel, when you begin to serve people and do sacrificial things, it points you to the Father who is more compassionate, who is more sacrificial. And what that does is it makes you humble and it makes you grateful. It doesn't ruin you. It strengthens you. Now, Christianity gives you incredible resources to become truly compassionate and to truly be sacrificial in ways that it isn't self-serving. Hey, look at me. Look at what I'm doing. Christianity gives you resources so that you do it, but in doing it, it humbles you. It makes you remember, this is what I look like before God. But praise God for his grace. And that's a very different dynamic. Without God, who you praise yourself. With God, you end up praising him. One makes you proud, one makes you humble. Just to tie it into something we were talking about, whenever Thanksgiving and Christmas come around, for our church especially, we have these incredible opportunities. One of them is through Angel Tree. And I know for Alan, we were just emailing back and forth with the leaders, and we do have a new group of kids that we can sponsor, we can give gifts to. But that's just a start. You know, for those of you who look at that and go, wow, you know, I can do that and I can be done with it for the year and I can feel like I've done, I hope you do. But we also hope that this is just kind of a start, that your faith leads you to do even more. And hopefully that our faith as a church leads us to do even more. Not because we have so much and God has given us so much and we sit on top of the food chain and we're able to do these different things, but simply because we know what it's like spiritually to be homeless, to be lost. We know what it's like spiritually to not belong. And now that Jesus has brought us in, we want to bring other people in too. So that's one of the wonderful things coming up. I hate doing things that sound like advertisements, but there it is. That's one of the ways that his faith comes alive is in his care for Esther. And again, in the story, that's emphasized all throughout the entire book, again and again and again for that reason. The third way in which Mordecai's faith comes to bear is through his allegiance to the king. And that's this last part we see about the plot. Verse 19, we find out that, you know, this new thing is taking place. The virgins are gathered again. There's differences of what's going on and why this is happening. And again, Mordecai has a position in the palace. Through his position, he hears about these two eunuchs who are angry for some unknown reason. They plan to kill the king, and he runs off to Esther. Esther tells the king, and she credits him. Now, there's a lot of foreshadowing going on. A lot of foreshadowing, because all of this really plays into the later part of the story where Haman is trying to really push Mordecai down. If you remember, there's that part where Ahasuerus or Xerxes can't sleep. He has the record read back to him, and he realizes he never rewarded Mordecai for what Mordecai's done here, and that plays a huge part in what God does at the end. What's interesting is we also see this foreshadowing that there's trouble brewing. You know, previously we see that it's a time of peace in the palace, but all of a sudden we see the trouble is brewing. We have Bigthan and Teresh, and eventually, right after we see that the storms are brewing, Haman comes on. You know, and Haman's the true storm that God is going to deal with. So, you know, all that's this deep, this beautiful foreshadowing that's taking place by the author. But what's interesting to me is we see this way in which Mordecai's faith works out, in which he shows allegiance to the king. Again, Mordecai overhears these plans to assassinate Xerxes. And you know what? Very honestly, he has every reason to ignore it and to let everything take place. I mean, think about it for a second. He's a Jew living in a country that has essentially destroyed his country. I mean, that would make me really angry. You know, I wouldn't be, there's a part that even if you had a good job working in the palace, there would be a part where if it was a lot of us, who would say, you know, there would be a certain allegiance to our people, to our homeland, to our country. And when the Persians went through, they didn't just go through and say, you know what, we're going to change the government. It's like ISIS. I mean, they went in, they destroyed things. They tore down the temple. They burned it. They destroyed the walls of Jerusalem. They killed people. They sacked and they ransacked the area. This isn't polite at all. You know, matter of fact, all through history, ancient history, we see that the Jews constantly rebel. They constantly rise up. Because of the fact that they're so angry about all these oppressions that have happened to them. So, you know, in that sense, you could kind of understand if Mordecai said, oh, you know, these two eunuchs are trying to get the king, I'll just let it happen. I mean, it'd be understandable to some degree. In addition, you could imagine that Mordecai would say, you know, beginning of chapter 1, we see that the king is throwing these lavish parties. They are immoral, and there's these terrible things happening. He could take a spiritual dislike and say, this is an affront to me as a Jew. You know, I can't believe that this is a part of the kingdom. Look at all these people, you know, drunk and sexually, all these things. He could have said, fine, you want to kill the king? That would be better for us, right? You know, you could look at it and Mordecai could make the case. He could say, you know, working here, I've had to compromise my faith so much, be better just to be rid of this king. Or, and this is the most personal, he could have been angry because of Esther. I mean, Esther is in essence forced to be a part of this perverted beauty pageant. And according to Jewish custom, he's defiled by this pagan king. I mean, a Jewish girl isn't supposed to sleep with someone before her marriage, much less a non-Jew. You know, in our culture, in our time, we would probably classify this as rape to some degree. And so it makes perfect sense that Mordecai would be, I mean, this is the girl that he brought up as his daughter. know, none of us would want to see this happen to our children, to our daughters. And so Mordecai could have just said, you know what? He deserves this. He's a pig. But you know, the reason why he didn't keep quiet is because, you know, what we see is he for some reason, he has this allegiance to this king. And so he hears the plan. He goes to Esther. He says, Esther, you have to tell the king this. This is happening. And, you know, and she goes and tells and says, this is Mordecai. This is coming from him. You know, protect yourself. And he does. There's only, you know, we could ask the question, why did he do that? Because, again, he had every reason not to. The only reason why he would is if he had, the only reason why he would show allegiance to this king is if he had allegiance to another king, a king who was greater than Xerxes, a king who was a true king. And that's God. And the only way he could give allegiance to Xerxes as his king is if he knew that there was a God above him who essentially oversaw everything that Xerxes said and did. I mean, that's the way that's the only way you can show allegiance to a king like that, right? If you have a God that isn't all-powerful and all-knowing, who can do whatever he wants and does whatever is good, then you can, all you can do is despair. Oh my gosh, this is happening. Nothing can change that. If you have a God who knows and sees all and also does what is good, then you can be comfortable, even when you're not sure about the particular things that the king is doing. I mean, that's really the only reason you can show allegiance to another king is if you know that there is a king above him who will make things right and who does what is right and who has the power to do what is right. And that's what Mordecai believed in. And you know what? That takes faith. That takes trust. Because Xerxes didn't always do what was right. He didn't always do what was good. He didn't always do things that were just. He didn't always do things that were right. And it takes trust. It takes faith to say, you know what? God will make those things right. God will make those things good. Even though I do not agree with what he is doing, God will take care of it all. And you know, if you go to Romans chapter 13, that's what we see in the New Testament. That's one of the direction that, that's some of the direction that we're given. If you go to Romans chapter 13, we see that for us, God's sovereignty is the thing that allows us to give allegiance or to show, to be submissive to the government that is above us, the people who are in positions above us. It says, let every person, verse 1 and verse 2, be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God. And those that exist have been instituted by God. Therefore, whoever resists the authorities resists what God has appointed, and those who resist will incur judgment. Now, does that mean that the Bible does not allow for protests? No, there are times where God specifically tells us to do things, and we do them. But what Romans 13 is saying that the general idea, the general principle is we can show allegiance to those who are above us because they sit under God, and our true allegiance is to him, not them. Now, I'm going to say something scary. I think some of you kind of know where this is going. We have a lot happening in the next few weeks. And for some of you, I can tell you very honestly, when I take God out of the picture, it's really scary. We have two people who are running for president, and I don't know how you guys feel. In my mind, I don't know if there is a good choice. I could see it going either way and going, this is horrible. You know, and I want to be equal on both sides. I think that's equally true on either side. I think what Mordecai shows and what Romans 13 reminds me of is this. No matter what happens, I have a God above whoever gets elected. I have a God who is bigger than the president. And that God is the one that I show my true allegiance to. And if you do not believe in a God who is sovereign, who is powerful, and who is also loving, then if the wrong person gets in, you will be in despair. You'll pull your hair out and you go, oh my gosh, what is going to happen to us? But if you believe in a God who sees all, who knows all, and who does what's good, then you won't be fazed. You may not like it, but it will not destroy you. You know, for some of us, like I said, when the new president gets elected, we're going to have a lot of problems with that. And it could be for very different reasons. But I think the scriptures remind us, you know, that the way, one way in which we trust God, and the only way we can do this is through trusting God, is for us to show our allegiance to those who lead us. Now, what does that mean? I think that means that as believers, whenever the election finally gets finalized and power is shifted, I think it means for us as believers that we are called then to pray for, to respect, and if possible, to protect whoever the president is. Regardless of how our politics align, regardless of how our personal feelings are, one of the funny things I've noticed over the last two or three elections is the group that doesn't get elected anymore, the group that doesn't win says, "That's not my president. That's not my president." I don't remember that like 20 years ago. I don't remember that 30 years ago. I don't remember that, I wasn't like 50 years ago. I wasn't here then. I don't remember that. But I do remember when I was younger, I remember even though there was disagreements across the sides, I remember everyone saying, "That's our president." And for good or for ill, we're in it together. Something has changed. And I think that thing that's changed, unfortunately, has come from the Christian circle, unfortunately, or the conservative circle. In the most, living your faith out doesn't just mean learning how to read the Bible better in the morning. Doesn't mean simply how to, you know, how to share Jesus with people when the opportunity arises. You are going to need faith. You're going to need to trust God when the election is over. Let me just put it that way. One way or another, you're going to have to be able to trust God, because in some ways you can't trust anything else. And if you don't have God, or if you don't trust him, all hope will be lost. And you see, that's why faith matters. Faith doesn't just fill in the gaps, like we said last week. Faith matters because even when things don't happen the way that you want them to happen, you know that there is still a power above the powers, and that with this ultimate power, there is love in there. And because of that, you do not have to worry. That here is a God who is in control of it all, who also loves you, and he will always do what is good and right. And even when things look wrong, you can trust him. You know, the last question I wanted to end with is this. I think there's still the sense in which we say, well, how can I trust God through terrible things like the wrong president being elected? You know, how can I trust God through terrible things happening? You know, that's actually what the cross is about, isn't it? Jesus goes to the cross and he dies, and all his disciples despair. But you know, even when the wrong thing happened, in God's hands, it was the right thing. Even though Jesus physically, life ebbed away, his body slumped, and everyone said, "My gosh, he's really dead," God was still at work. And 3 days later, they went to the tomb to simply take care of his body, clean some things up, and go back to their miserable lives, knowing that this terrible tragedy had happened. They went into the tomb, and he was gone. See, that's how God works. The center of our faith, the death and resurrection of Christ, tells us that the most terrible thing can happen, and yet it can be the most beautiful. How can I trust God through terrible things happening, whether it's the election, whether it's my personal life, whatever else it is? I go to the cross and I remember that the most terrible thing that has ever afflicted humankind was for our good, that Jesus died. But in his death, he has been resurrected so that we too could live. That's the only way you can have hope. And like I said, as the election comes, that's the only way you can feel good at all when it's all over, to know that there is a God who is above it all, a God who works even through the tragedies. Let's pray together.